From the Sky News Centre at 5, the American woman accused of murdering Meredith Kercher claims she was beaten by police. Amanda Knox has told an Italian court she was confused when questioned in the days after the British student was killed. She and her ex-boyfriend deny murdering Meredith in Perugia in 2007. Knox also claims she was pressured into implicating former bar owner Patrick Lumumba in the death.
They told me that I was trying to protect someone, but I wasn't trying to protect anyone. And so I didn't know how to respond to them, but they continued to call me a stupid liar.
A man accused of kidnapping his British-based daughter during a supervised visit has been found guilty by a US jury. Lawyers for Clark Rockefeller, whose real name is Christian Carl Gerhard Reiter, argued he was legally insane when he disappeared with 7-year-old Ray Boss in Boston last year. The killers of Ben Kinsler have been jailed to shouts of bye-bye from the public gallery of an Old Bailey court. They'll serve a minimum of 19 years for stabbing the 16-year-old in North London last June. Hazel Blair says she regrets the timing of her resignation from the government. The former community secretary caused huge anger in the Labour ranks by walking out of the cabinet the day before last week's elections. She denies her decision was designed to inflict maximum damage on Prime Minister Gordon Brown.
These are always matters of judgment. I think that in hindsight that judgment was wrong. I think the effect on the party just before the elections is something that I will, you know, regret forever.
In tennis, Andy Murray has reached the semi-final of the Queen's Club Championships. He's beaten America's Mardy Fish 7-5, 6-3 in their last 8 clash. He'll face Juan Carlos Ferrero next. And Madonna's said to be excited she's going to be a mum again. The US pop star has been told she can adopt a little girl from Malawi after all, having appealed against an earlier decision. 4-year-old Mercy James will live with Madonna's first adopted child, David, and her 2 other children in New York. That's the latest. I'm Dave Terrace.
BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Do you think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Call 0800 612 0225. Or visit our website on www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612 0225.
Już wkrótce na falach BCFM, Radiowski, audycja w języku polskim. Zaczynamy w niedzielę 17 maja o godzinie 19.
Radiowski, Polish Language Broadcasting, Sunday at 7 p.m.
Wake up to yesterday on BCFM. Midnight to midday, we repeat all the programmes so you can catch up on all the ones you've missed or just enjoy them again. BCFM 93.2 FM. Your choice, your voice.
Welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and in the studio this week we have 2 local politicians. John Rogers is Ashley Ward councillor from the leading Liberal Democrat group on Bristol City Council, and Ron Stone is from the Labour group. He just managed to retain his seat last week in the St George West ward. Political pundit Martin Summers is away this week, as is Marina Morris, who's off for a well-deserved holiday in the Cotswolds. But Drive Time's Neil Roberts has been taking a close look this week at the near miss we had avoiding a potentially disastrous bin men's strike. Why was the city facing the nightmare of rubbish piling up on our streets? But before that, here's our 2-week Friday Drive Time weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend, temperatures quite warm, around 18, 19 degrees Celsius, sunny, and a sprinkling of rain on Saturday, that's tomorrow. Winds light. Next week, around 18 to 19 degrees Celsius most of the week, but colder on Wednesday. Cloud cover and rain on Monday and Tuesday. Thursday morning will be nice and sunny. Wind gusting a bit again on Wednesday. Next weekend, that's the 20th and 21st of June, is looking cooler, sunny periods, and again a little drizzle on Saturday. And the week after next, sunny, a rain-free week with winds very light. And that was the long-range weather forecast for the next fortnight from metcheck.com. Now we start this week with a look at the near miss there's been with an indefinite possible bin strike, which was averted. Neil Roberts reports.
Well, I was planning on reporting today on the mounting piles of uncollected rubbish filling the streets of Bristol, but as you know, there aren't any. Bristol's refuse workers were due to begin indefinite strike action from Wednesday morning in an escalation of their pay dispute with their employer, CETA. The 270 bin workers and street cleaners had already taken 5 days of strike action over 2.5 weeks before voting to take all-out action from Wednesday. Then, on Tuesday morning, the union, CETA and the city council announced that a deal had been reached in the last-minute negotiations and the planned strike action was called off. At the heart of the dispute was a pay increase, which Workers Unite Union say was promised for November 2008 but was never implemented by CETA. The union say that when CETA won the privatised contract for refuse collection from the council in 1994, there was an agreement that pay would rise in line with inflation every November, as was the case when workers were employed directly by the council. However, CETA has failed to award this pay increase since November 2007. In November last year, inflation was running at close to 5%, but CETA offered only a rise of 2.75%, effectively a pay cut. The union wanted a 5% increase, about £20 a week rise in line with the cost of living. Since November, the union tried to negotiate increases of 4.5%, 3.5% and inflation plus 1%. However, CETA refused to move on their 2.75% offer. The unions say that CETA deliberately dragged negotiations out from November to now to exploit falling inflation and are now using the excuse of the recession to refuse the 5% increase. CETA say that the 2.75% is a fair offer in the current economic climate. The deal reached on Tuesday means that workers will accept CETA's original 2.75% along with a one-off payment for clearing the backlog. Both sides have agreed that future pay negotiations will go through binding arbitration with ACAS, the Independent Conciliation Service. The refuse workers and their unions say that the nature of CETA's contract means that the council also share responsibility for the pay deal. Bristol City Council pay CETA for all their operating costs, including wages, plus a 16% profit. CETA made £16 million profit in 2007, whilst its parent company, Suez, has a £12 billion annual turnover. Critics of privatisation of public services say that council taxpayers are paying more for services previously carried out by the council, whilst private companies like CETA make big profits and try to force down their workers' wages. CETA itself has a reputation across the country for trying to drive down workers' wages and conditions after taking over outsourced public services. In Brighton in 2001, CETA paid Brighton and Hove Council £3 million to get out of its nine-month-old refuse collection contract there. This followed a series of battles with workers and local residents over pay, conditions and service standards, which culminated in CETA sacking more than 100 workers who then occupied the depot. CETA, a company which bids for local government contracts, also has links to political parties. Last year it sponsored both the Labour and Conservative Party conferences, and between 2007 and 2008 it donated more than £22,000 to the Labour Party. It was also revealed last year, in the middle of the controversy about fortnightly rubbish collections, that CETA was paying former Labour local government minister Hilary Armstrong £30,000 a year as an advisor. So, our bins are being emptied now and the refuse workers have accepted CETA's original pay offer. But I don't think this will be the last we hear of this dispute. Workers apparently remain unhappy with the way they've been treated and what they see as bullying management tactics. I also understand that within a day of the deal being struck, CETA management sent letters to bin workers demanding that established health and safety practices be dropped in order to speed up bin collections. Some workers also believe that the council have some questions to answer about their role and responsibilities in this dispute.
So, Neil, what responsibility do the council have to ensure workers in privatised services are paid and treated fairly?
Sorry, what was that?
What responsibility do the council have to ensure workers in privatised services are paid and treated fairly?
I don't know. I thought you were going to ask the councillors that.
Okay, well, I can put some of these to the councillors because they are both with us now. So I'm happy to welcome Councillor John Rogers and Councillor Ron Stone. Now, just to explain, John Rogers is Liberal Democrat councillor for Ashley. That's St Paul's, pretty much, is it?
It's St Paul's, Montpellier, St Werburgh's, and a little bit of St Andrews up by the park.
And Ron, let me just get you on the microphone there. Yeah. Ron, you're Labour councillor for St George West. Now, what do you both think of the bin strike, John, if you want to go first?
Right, well, I must admit I haven't been closely involved in the bin strike. I'm aware that we have a contract with CETA, and I'm aware that there's been an industrial dispute between CETA and some of their workforce. I know that there's been a lot of concern both about the terms and conditions for the staff, but also about the non-collection of bins across the city, and many people have been complaining about their rubbish not being collected. So, but I'm very glad that the dispute's been resolved. It sounds like it's been resolved in a way that is satisfactory to both parties. The council has a responsibility to award the contracts for the bin services, and obviously those contracts do include requirements that the staff are treated fairly under normal employment practice. But I don't think that it's actually appropriate for the council to get directly involved in such negotiations. It's important that the managers and their unions and the staff themselves resolve these things, as they appear to have done.
But, I mean, isn't this just a way of the council washing their hands of it? I mean, this is one of the things that's happened with privatisation, isn't it? That this is it, the council is now one step removed from the services that they're paying for.
The council still has a still has a contract to actually allow. It allows them to contract to say that we need these services done, and indeed we've actually succeeded in getting these done. If the dispute had been directly between council staff and the council itself, we wouldn't have had the resources that CETA have to bring in people to clear backlogs and so on, which has been happening. So I think that certainly from my perspective, people are. The majority of people in Bristol are probably more thinking about the fact that many people are losing their jobs and are not particularly sympathetic to people who are looking for 5% pay rises, when many people are taking pay cuts just to keep their businesses and their organisations going. It's a very, I mean, I think it's something which we need to look at in the light of the whatever arbitration agreement is agreed, but there is binding arbitration, and I understand the binding arbitration goes over 3 years, and that's been agreed by both the Unite Union and the staff and CETA.
Let's hope so. Anyway, over to you, Ron. Yeah. What's your view about this it was a dispute for a little while, wasn't it? But most people are really, I think, annoyed about the fact that we were facing rubbish in the streets piling up. Yeah. Why should people have to put up with this?
Well, the thing is, I disagree with John in relation to the role the City Council can play, even in privatised contracts. When we put out services to contract, then clearly there is a responsibility for us to get the best conditions we can in relation to the transfer of those staff. That's normally done as a regular basis. In this case, it certainly seems as if CETA have cut very severely into what would be seen to be basic employment expectation and support for people. And I think that's one element that probably aggravates the situation. When it came to a dispute, clearly the negotiations are between whoever we have given and granted the contract to and the people that work in that contract. But bearing in mind the weather that we had, and bearing in mind that there seemed to be no end to this dispute, I do believe that the City Council should have stepped in earlier and tried to bring the parties together, even if it was only in a mediation role, because of the health issues that were on the street, and it was certainly building up in my ward.
Do you think that this is it's appropriate for them to be taking strike action when actually, as you say, we could be facing health issues on the streets?
Well, that's the same question that you could ask anybody that's in a frontline service to people. You can ask, is it fair for nurses to go on strike? Remember, Tuppence for the NHS, that was years back. You probably weren't even born then. But, I mean, it's the same thing, police, etc. And I think the thing that was forgotten and probably misrepresented in the press and the media was the fact that these people had not had a basic rise for 2 years. And so what they had asked for was not 5% in 1 year, but basically something to try and mitigate and catch up some of the monies that they've had to find. They don't get preferential electricity, water, gas, or other issues cheaply for them. Their mortgages were equally as dear before the recession came round. And so I think it's a question of really fully understanding before people criticise what stances that people make, because they are desperate.
Well, one of the criticisms in this dispute was that CETA are actually paying quite a lot to their shareholders, whilst they're not that the profits that they're making aren't finding their way down to the actual workers on the ground. John, have you got a reply to that? Because it does seem that there's money coming, being taken out of the bin service and going to shareholders, where maybe it should be going to the workers.
Well, I think that the workers are doing a great job. And I mean, if you look at the city, the Bristol as a whole, we've increased our recycling from 12% up to 40%. It's slipped back a bit over the last couple of years, but we'll soon reverse that trend. And we will need the full engagement of the staff and the companies to actually deliver that. CETA are presumably, I think the figures I've seen, it was about CETA profits in 2007, and obviously we've had 2008 and now we're in 2009, and things are very different in terms of an economic situation now than they were 2 years ago. They've also been privatised since 1994. This is not a new arrangement. This has been going on for many, many years. And so to sort of say that the council should get back involved, and actually if the council had got involved big time, it could have inflamed things, it could have made matters worse, not better. And I think it's very important that we should literally just take a watching brief to keep an eye on what's going on, give advice, give it support for both staff and companies.
What about you, Ron?
Well I spent 2 days separate days talking to the union members that were demonstrating on College Green. And I talked to them on the basis that, in my view, with the weather like it was and the increasing problems that people were facing on the doorstep, it was wrong for the City Council to take the attitude John's just outlined. I felt that without getting involved in the actual negotiation of percentage, they should have mediated and brought the parties together much quicker. And that's the role that I think that should have been taken up immediately.
I mean, do you think this issue?
There were offers, though, right from the word go, from the council. Was indeed mediation has been on the table all along. I think that the unions were unhappy to accept that, and even on the Monday they voted against, narrowly, but they voted against accepting mediation at that stage. There were further discussions on Monday and Tuesday, and I understand that they then, I think it was the Wednesday morning, that they did accept the terms, and I think there were some amendments then. But I think there has always been mediation on the table. It's been a case of, but I really don't see that getting another party who doesn't have a direct link in with this involved directly in discussing with the with CETA and with the unions and with the staff. That I can't see that would necessarily bring things to a quicker conclusion than we've actually already had.
Well, I disagree with that on the basis that it was an in-house service to begin with. It was contracted
in 1994.
Yeah, to begin with, and then we've contracted it out, and we've entrusted that service to an agency, CETA, and we've also got a responsibility to the 400,000 people in this city in relation to the services they get and the quality of life, if you like, in the ward. And if we get to a situation where we do have health issues actually on people's doorsteps, I mean, there was rats in Clout Hill Road, for example, then I think the City Council cannot just sit back and wash its hands like Pontius Pilate and say,
I don't think there's any case of
that. You need to recognise that, recognise what the issues could be, and to try and bring that to.
But Ron, I mean, are you prepared to grasp the nettle here? If Labour were in control, would you be seriously considering bringing these services back in house and away from CETA, and actually, you know, maybe considering even cancelling contracts with them?
The last time I was involved with anything in contracts was the ground maintenance contract when it was in Avon, and I was responsible for that, and that went out to Brophy's, which was basically two men and a dog. It totally failed, and yes, we brought it back in house. And so I think you have to be, you know, and grasp the nettle, as you say. And
so is that Labour policy in Bristol now?
No, I'm speaking as an individual. What I'm saying is, I believe that you do need, and there is a responsibility on the council to look at how effective private contracts are. home care was another one, elderly prisoners' homes, and the arrangement of that, again under Avon. That was going to go out to Gloucester, and it didn't, and it stayed in-house. And so I think you have to be honest enough to stand and look at whether you've made a mistake or not, whether there is an issue or not, and you need to be, and not forget the people who put you there. The people in St George and the people in Ashley have put John and I in the position that we're in, and we have a responsibility, in my view, to give those people the best services that they can have.
And so is this totally out of the question for the Liberal group to consider some sort of in-house council service for some of these frontline services if the contracts break down or if there are strikes and that sort of thing?
There's no indication that the contracts will break down. The contracts are being delivered. There was a brief period where the contract was not delivered in the way that any of us would like. That's now been corrected. We have abilities to impose penalties and all sorts of things if the services aren't delivered in the way that the people of Bristol want. So there's lots of scope to control and influence the contracts in the way that they're delivered in the city.
Finally, for both of you, do you think this whole business has worked with the twice weekly bin collection? Because that was quite controversial when it happened, the idea that rubbish is only being collected once a fortnight.
It's rubbish is actually the recycling is once a week. And that's the main issue. We're trying to encourage recycling. That change in scheme increased the recycling from 12% to 40%. Huge jump. We became one of the best cities in the country. So that's from that perspective, it's working well. The only materials that should be in the black bin, which is collected every 2 weeks, should be plastics, which up until now have been difficult to recycle, and we hope to get those sorted. There are now 5 sites around the city which will take all plastics, so we're developing alternative sets. So really there should be nothing to be collected every 2 weeks, and certainly in our household it's 4 weeks between times when the bins get full. We should be working towards recycling, reducing our waste and recycling as much as possible, and there should be very little residual waste left over.
But I mean, surely it's unrealistic to expect everybody to sort all of their rubbish into a recycling container rather than having, I mean, there's always things that don't go into any of those recycling containers.
Very little now, very little. Can you give me some examples of what doesn't go into the
We'll see, we'll see. Ron, what do you think about the two twice-weekly bin
collections? I know what John claims. The problem is that the recycling went up, but the budget that was set by the Liberal Democrats actually was in deficit by doing it. It's had to be re-corrected. There's been a terrific amount of uncertainty about what goes in where, terrific amount of confusion, particularly for the elderly people in Redfield, in my ward, for example. I know we think it's clear and easy, but it's not. I'm not against recycling, don't get me wrong, but the way in which it was set up originally, it cost us a hole in the budget that we had to take over when we retook control. And so although those figures went up, it was at a cost and outside of budget.
Okay, well, let's move on to look at some of the other things in this week's news. The main thing, main piece of news today is this surprise announcement that Banksy has been secretly putting an exhibition together up at the art gallery at the top of Park Street, and that's opening tonight.
It's actually at the Bristol Museum.
Oh, it's at the museum.
Bristol City Museum. It's council property.
Oh, fantastic.
He's invaded council property.
Well, he's coming
without
from
the council knowing about
he's
it.
He's coming from the dark side, it seems, and he's no longer some sort of illegal graffiti artist making criminal damage on our walls, and he's kind of been brought in house. What do you think about the whole sort of graffiti art issue, John?
I think this is just fantastic news for Bristol. It's brilliant. He's such a character and an enigmatic character of now international reputation, and I think many Bristolians are proud that he comes from Bristol. His works are dotted around the city, and some of them we've sadly lost now, but there are some great ones, including on Stokescroft. There's the Mild Mild West, which is there, and there's been obviously the one on Park Street, which many people wanted removed because it was graffiti on a council building. But we had a sort of referendum on the website, and 93% of people responding wanted it to stay. So it's still there, that wonderful picture just over the bridge by Park Street, right by the side of the council house. So talk about a little snub to the council.
So do you approve of this form of criminal damage?
I think that where it is as artistic and as talented as this, it's great. I think there's a difference between street art and graffiti and just tagging and that sort of thing. If someone scrawls their signature onto a piece of bath stone wall or something and it's difficult to remove and so on, that's quite different from a carefully chosen spot which is going to enhance the way that the city appears. And this, and taking over the museum and doing it in such absolute secrecy, I was actually aware of it last night at 8:30 that this had happened, and I was sworn to secrecy about it until it was released this morning in the Evening Post. And I was looking on the internet to see if there was any hints somewhere on the internet that this was about to happen, and there weren't. It was, I mean, I'm astonished that they managed to keep this as secret as they did.
What do you think about the issue then, Ron?
Well, quality street art I'm in favour of. Okay.
Quality street, like yeah, chocolates.
No, quality street art I'm in favour of.
And do you think Banksy fits into that category?
Yes, very definitely. I'm with John on the tagging issue. Tagging, I think, is really destructive and antisocial. And, for example, in the park in St George, we've got the wheelie park and the skate park. And that's got an international and national reputation because it's one of the first ones that was ever established in a major city. There's a whole website, apparently, to it. But that's got tagged. And so one of the plans for the park is to be able to put quality street art on that with the users, skaters and everything else. And so instead of being a tagged, unsightly mess at the beginning of the park, you'd actually have some 360 artworks. It benefit the people in Lindale Road that overlook the park, but also benefit the approach to the park at the same time. In relation to using the museum, I understand that there was a suggestion about a year ago that he would hold an exhibition somewhere in the southwest, and a very tight lid has been kept on it because one of his very close associates, I understand, as soon as they realised what was going on in the museum, put two and two together. But no, I didn't know about it either. But providing, I think, it's done in a sensitive and proper way that's respectful to the building and can be put back again, I think that's fine. I mean, the art foundation opposite the Victoria Rooms, they had a similar
West thing. Of England.
West of England, College of Art and et cetera. They had an exhibition where they actually sprayed the walls. Now, that worried me a bit. I hope we don't go that far. But, other than that, I think, the proper three-dimensional quality street art, I think, is excellent. And I wish I could do it.
Do you think that there's an issue, though, for young people about freedom of expression, that they feel that there is nowhere that they can express themselves, and that they're doing this for a reason? Or is it just a vandalism?
Oh, I think it is about marking
territory.
We're
talking about the tagging here.
The tagging is, I think, about marking territory, making places feel as if they're part of themselves. I was particularly involved in Happy Lane, which is in St Andrews. There was a lot of problems with tagging. It was really unsightly all the way down a narrow lane down to the school children were there. There was offensive graffiti and so on. And the local residents got together, painted it all out, and then painted out whenever it reappeared, and within weeks of doing that, it just stopped happening, because one of the reasons is people want to be able to show their mates the work they've done. And of course, if they couldn't, if it'd gone by the following morning or within 24 hours, they lose interest. So I think, but there are ways in which there's lots of projects, there's lots of parts of the city where there is street art. We're actually actively encouraging street art in places like Stokes Croft and working out ways of actually letting people feel as if the city is theirs. And I think that's what I would like to see, and get young people feeling that it is their city. It's not just for old fuddy-duddies like me and Ron.
So Ron, do you think, is it just vandalism, the tagging, simple vandalism, or is there an issue of freedom of expression?
I agree
somewhere?
With John that I've often said that Bristol's quite a tribal city. What I mean by that is that the natural boundaries in the city between wards and the hills and the river, etc., you find quite a lot of communities at the bottom of the hill don't talk to communities at the top. They're quite isolated. And I think that overflows into young people where, you know, the people of one area want to say that this is our area, keep out, and this is what tagging's about. I'm not in favour of that at all. But in Meadowvale, for example, we had a lot of vandalism on the back of Meadowvale Community Centre's storage area, where they kept a lot of their equipment. And we got the young people of the estate to come off and to actually paint it out and actually put a mural and some street art on it themselves. And it stopped. And we haven't had any problems since. And so I think it's a question of really about ownership and how far you take it.
Okay, let's move on from the Banksy phenomenon and the graffiti, street art, whatever you want to call it. We just hear this week that there's a multi-million pound of work is beginning at Bristol Airport for some sort of bridge that they're building there. Now, I hope you've had a chance to look through that story. But, I mean, is this the right time to be investing in air travel with all these worries about climate change, John?
Well, you may be aware we put I seconded a motion about to say that we shouldn't be expanding Bristol Airport at this time. So I think that my personal feeling is no, it is not the right time to be expanding it. We have a challenging target on climate change of reducing CO2 emissions by 80%, and we can't do that if we're going to expand Heathrow Airport and Bristol Airport in the way that we've been currently are planned.
But of course the airport operators will say there's more and more demand, more and more planes want to land there, so that we've got to do something.
Well, I think that a lot of it is related to the fact that the way that the economics of air flight, the fuel is free of tax. Aviation fuel is free of tax, so people, it's actually much cheaper to run. There's very large there's no has a big impact on the surrounding North Somerset. So there's poor transport links to there. So there's lots of cars going driving across there, which is just not conducive to a clean, healthy environment. And we should be thinking much more about what it is we're doing to our planet.
Ron, should we be investing in Bristol Airport, or yes, should be Bristol Airport be investing in itself?
Yes,
is this the right time?
I think we should invest in Bristol Airport for a number of reasons. First thing is that John's stated about climate change and the targets that we have to look at. But if you have to get into a diesel-powered bus and drive 50, 60 people to a plane and back again on short journeys and whatever, that's the use of carbon fuel. It's not efficient, etc. So there's the sheer practicality of getting people between terminal and plane without using carbon fuel. Now, surely that's a good reason for doing it. Second one is the major recession in the southwest. Anywhere that invests in jobs for the construction industry, etc., I think should be seriously looked at. I don't say everything should be supported, but certainly a lot of it should go on. And thirdly, do we want to be the Southwest capital? Do we really mean what we say? If we do, then we need good transport links and networks. And certainly the road network to Bristol Airport is not the best. And certainly the facilities at Bristol Airport, which has developed over the years with more and greater international flights, and attracting more and business and interest in the city, it's only promoting the ability for local employment. But if we haven't got those facilities that people feel comfortable with and can be efficient in the way in which they use it, then I think it's very sad. So I think, yes, I think we do need to seriously look at Bristol Airport and what's there. And if we can reduce carbon fuel use in that respect by people walking between terminals and not getting soaking wet, then so much the better.
But it's ludicrous, isn't it, where you've got a situation that you can fly to Alicante and back for £10 and it costs you £155 to go to London by train. So we have this ridiculously, the completely the wrong economy around travel, and we could have high-speed train links to London and to Europe. It is quicker. to go from Bristol to Paris by train than it is to go from Bristol to Paris by plane. And we should be pointing that out, and we should be making the price of that equivalent, unfortunately, because all the subsidies which are going into airport expansion, it isn't. And I would much rather see investment in jobs in rail and local transport initiatives than I would in terms of Ryanair or any of those.
Sorry,
others.
Did you just say that it's quicker to go by train from Bristol to Paris than it is to go by plane? Because I find that a bit difficult to believe.
By the time that you've got out of the... If you go from Bristol Temple Meads, it takes you 1 hour, 30 minutes to get to London.
To Paddington.
Paddington, and 3 hours to get to Paris.
Okay.
From there. So that's 4.5 hours to get to the centre of Paris. To get, you have to arrive at the airport 2 hours early.
Okay. So you're talking about the transit times and things.
The total time it takes. So you have to leave at 6. If you leave at 6 o'clock in the morning, you get there. You can get there by 10:30 by train and 10:30 by plane
but of course
to the centre of London.
The thing with the planes is it might cost you a small fortune to leave your car there if you've driven up there, so you better get the bus, I think, to the airport. Anyway, Ron, have you got anything more to add on this one? What about, you know, this is quite an interesting subject, isn't it? You know, the idea that it's costing far less to go by plane than it is to go by train, even to somewhere like London.
Well, I mean, obviously, bucket flights, etc., is much cheaper to fly. Councillors, and when we go to conferences, for example, in Newcastle or Edinburgh, it's much cheaper to fly than it is to go.
But not for the environment.
Yeah, that's right. And it seems silly, doesn't it? Because all these trains are going with empty seats. The train companies aren't, it seems, interested in filling those seats up where the plane companies are.
Yeah.
So anyway,
can you blame anybody if they can get to Edinburgh for 10 quid, for example?
Well, it's very difficult to criticise people for going for it when the prices are so cheap by choosing the cheapest method, isn't it? Especially in these hard times.
Exactly.
Anyway, let's move on to talking about the post office, because we had a programme on a couple of weeks ago about post office privatisation with Kevin Beezer from the Communication Workers Union on Church Road here, talking about what that was actually likely to mean. And really, I just wanted to ask you both what you think about that. Is it a runner? Is post office privatisation, it seems, is now much less likely because there's a new minister been appointed who is an opponent, a former opponent of privatisation. So what are both of you's thoughts on this whole sort of debacle of possible privatisation of the post office? John, come on, first.
Me first again.
Yeah,
okay.
Go on.
I think it's something which the post office has been starved of investment for many, many years. And one way of potentially getting investment in is to privatise some of it. We're losing loads of post offices. And the Liberal Democrat proposal is to have 49% in the private sector and use that investment to actually reopen the post offices and get the services running again. We would remove a lot of the rules and regulations which surround post offices and mean that they would be unfettered and be able to compete properly with the independent sector.
Yeah, but we're rather fed up with hearing that the government can't afford to do all these sorts of things when all the money that's been given to the banks, you know,
you've got billions and billions to the banks, you've got billions and billions of an unnecessary Iraq war. There's loads of examples of things where this government has wasted large sums of money. But we still have to have, we have a situation where this government, the last 10 to 12 years, has closed down half the post offices, and as did the one before. And so we need some alternatives to it. Just saying that we're going to put lots of taxpayers' money into it, I don't think is an option. But in terms of building up a business model that works for local post offices, encouraging local post offices, that is a real runner. And it's a Liberal Democrat national policy, not local.
What Kevin was saying was that companies like TNT have been allowed into the industry to cream off the high profit margin areas of the post office.
Take the easy bits. They've taken off the easy bits. They haven't got the awkward long drives that things that they can just choose it. And they can actually subcontract to the post office to deliver the bits they don't want to do. The whole thing is just designed to make some of these businesses richer, and we should be unfettering our own post office so that they can be on an even level playing field.
What would you say about this, Ron?
Well, if I could speak from the local post offices here in Bristol East, when the proposal came out, I don't want to lose local post offices because clearly many of the people I represent don't have standard bank accounts and don't bank online, etc. The post office is where they've traditionally drawn their pension. And I went to talk to the owners and the operators, and offered to start a petition to keep the post offices open. What I found was that we had one local guy that was operating three post offices, and he begged me not to do anything because he'd already agreed the compensation package for shutting two of them. And so on that basis, there was nowhere to go. Now, if you've got people that want to sell out or buy out the service, that is an issue. I do think that there's a real problem for people in rural areas where the post office is just about everything. I mean, it's normally the village shop and everything else. And I think that is sad. And basically, the other issue is that there's so many things being taken away from the post office. And you can now, you know, tax your car by phone. You can do it online, etc. Many of the traditional services that the consignees actually got some profit or payment for is now available through other agencies because communications moved on.
And the government's taken those things away. So even though we struggle very hard to keep our child benefits paid through the post office, the government was pushing us to get a bank account and take it away from the local post office.
But there's also a question in relation to the local banks, because one gentleman in the ward told me that every time he actually went to his bank to get his pension now, he was actually being charged for the benefit of taking his own pension out. In other words, he's being taxed on his pension a second time. And I've taken that up because I don't think that's fair. So there's some agreement between John and I in relation to this. But I do think it's very difficult to actually sort through what the post office is supposed to be delivering and where it's going. And I really do think there is a need to look at it and its future. And I personally would prefer to see it and not in private hands, etc.
But I mean, you're speaking as a Labour councillor. Are you saying that this should be retained as a nationalised industry into the indefinite future then, are you?
As an individual, yes.
But your party doesn't.
Yes, but that doesn't stop me from being in my party arguing my corner, does
Absolutely
it?
Not, no. It would be, maybe we will chat to you a little bit later about what you think about the whole sort of New Labour thing. We've been discussing that the last few weeks as well. Another story that's come out this week, I think it was yesterday or the day before, was a crackdown on homeschooling. Anyone that teaches their children at home, apparently, sometime in the near distant future, is going to have to register for a licence to do so and face annual checks. Now, what do you both think about that? Maybe this time you can have a go first, Ron.
Well, I haven't heard this.
Well, but it's out there in the national news yesterday and the day before. So, I mean, you know, the idea of homeschooling, is it something you approve of?
Well, hopefully not. I mean, I can see in certain circumstances there are children that do need support at home. That goes without saying. Certainly some children with special needs, etc., where there's no provision.
Yeah, but do you think it should be the parents' choice as to whether their children are schooled at home or whether they are sent to school in a normal way?
I'm a believer in choice, but I would hope that the system that we can provide is attractive enough for people not to want to do that and walk away.
I mean, because there's a lot of changes happening in the way schools are run with the academy school system and this kind of thing. And it may mean that some parents aren't necessarily happy about sending their children along to school in the normal way.
Well, we've had this in another form, really, in Bristol for many years. And that is the people that wanted to send their children to the independent sector. And certainly some of the stats in relation to Bristol as an education performer under any political party. Right. If you look at the number of, private grammar schools, etc., and other agencies that people could choose, that certainly took out the top performers from our ability to be able to compete in national statistics. That's been true for a long time. I would hope that we could, with the academies, and we're sat virtually next door to one, aren't we?
Yes, be careful what we say here.
Yeah, well, absolutely. But I think they've done a wonderful job in bringing in better facilities, new technologies, a much more attractive learning environment, and the ability to get inclusion and communities together And in my view, that's a much more attractive policy than keeping your child isolated at home.
But at the end of the day, I'm trying to pin you down here, Ron. Yeah, if the parent decides that the schools that their children are being sent to are not suitable, should they be able to school them at home?
I would hope not.
Okay, John, I think
it's long been a right of people in this country to school their children at home should they choose to. I think what this report is saying is that there is some evidence that there are concerns about some of those children. As one of the people here says, he's met some extraordinarily accomplished young people who've prospered under home education, but he wasn't prepared to say that this was universal. Yeah. And I think if you've got a situation where some children, however few, are actually being perhaps abused, perhaps under difficult circumstances, then we do have a responsibility as sort of corporate parents, really, of to make sure that all the children in Bristol, for example, are safe and well looked after. And if there is a suggestion that there are children who are not under the close guidance of schools, so, for example, there is evidence that some of the children that have been taken out of schools are actually the ones that have been truanting and the parents are in some difficulty getting the children to school. So the reasons aren't because the parents' educational requirements, they're more because the parents are struggling perhaps with their own home circumstances, perhaps their own substance misuse or other problems that they may be suffering that makes them find it difficult to get the children to school, and they haven't perhaps had the help and support from the educational services to help them get their children to school. Then those, if they're saying we're going to educate our children at home for those reasons, then really we have to think about those children and whether they are actually best served by it.
Yeah, I mean, there are other reasons, though, aren't there? I mean, it's quite possible that parents that know their children being bullied at school and the school is not dealing with that bullying may decide, look, I'm not happy for them to be going to school
Absolutely.
Anymore.
Yeah.
And don't we need to be, surely, cooperating with parents so parents are sending their children to school by consent?
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely,
and that's the principle of it. But if a parent says, I don't want to send my child to school, then I think it's reasonable to find out why. If the reason is that they're being bullied at school, then that needs to be addressed, not saying, oh, you've got to keep your child at home. If, on the other hand, they've got deeply held religious beliefs or something that says, look, we feel that we are the best people to educate our children and we want to do it at home, that is their right.
So do you think that they should, any parent that wants to educate their children at school should actually have to apply, as it says in this news story, for a licence to do so?
I think it's not unreasonable to say we want to protect all the children that are in our city, and not just those that happen to go to school.
John, do you want a final word on this one? Ron, do you want a final word on this one?
Yeah, I mean, clearly there are some issues in relation to why aren't children happy in school, or why are they not attending. I mean, my comments were based on basically on educational choice, where there is a cogent reason. I mean, if bullying is there, then that is something that none of us can support. And certainly we need to be reflective of the potential for that, whether that's on a race issue or whether it's on a religious issue or whether it's on an individual basis. And so with children like that, I can understand fully why they may be withdrawn for a while, but we've got to improve the services that we provide to be able to be sensitive and quick enough to be able to pick up those issues. And in the academy here, I think the support networks that have been set up here in relation to children where English isn't their first language, and the possibilities of that type of tension in the school, and the way that Ray Priest has tackled that agenda, I think is something that other schools could learn in Bristol.
Okay, our final story, news story to look at in the High Court next Wednesday. This is a bit of a hot potato. It's the extraordinary story of Colin Port, the Avon and Somerset Chief Constable, who could wind up in jail for defying a High Court order. Mr. Port's been given this High Court order to hand back a computer belonging to someone called Jim Bates. Mr. Bates was an expert witness in child pornography cases and was arrested just before he was about to stand witness in another case of Graham Harris, who was another computer expert, a bit complicated this one, who this time was helping the Irish police's high-tech crime unit. Now, Colin Port is no stranger to controversy. In the South West One scandal, he chose his own wife to manage the privatisation of the police civilian support services and large parts of North Somerset Council. handing them over to IBM and as part of the privatisation. Now, any thoughts on this? The idea of the chief constable ending up in prison for defying a high court order?
My thought is that nobody's above the law, and I think if you look at the MPs at the moment, some of them ought to be facing the High Court over some of the things that they've been up to. So I think that no, it doesn't surprise me if someone's not living by the rules of the law, then they should be before the courts, whether they're the chief constable, whether they're the MP for in charge of moats,
or even the councillor for Ashley,
or even the councillor for Ashley. I'm very much not over above the law.
Well, nobody walks on water. And so if there's an issue and there's proof, then action should be taken.
Okay, so we'll follow that one closely, because that's particular story's up in the High Court Wednesday next week. So in a minute, we'll be having a little look at some of the closer-to-home stories and chatting to our Labour and Liberal councillors here about some more stories to do with the local council.
BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Okay, yes, I'm joined by John Rogers and Ron Stone. John is a Liberal councillor and Ron is a Labour councillor. We had a brief chat with Steve Coomer about this last week. Can either of you explain, because we have a rather peculiar election system here in Bristol, don't we? And since we've just had an election, do you want to just, Ron, maybe you could explain this, as you've been a councillor for longer, why it is that we have this weird election system in Bristol? It happens every 3 years, or there's a gap year or something?
Well, there was. Can I go back to 1985 when I was first elected? And at that time, the city had three councillors per ward, two for the city and one for Avon. And Avon was an all-out election every 4 years. When Avon was devolved, there was a nicety of debate in relation to whether there was any need for change. And some people felt that 4 years was too long to give any administration in a city. Other people argued that there was 4 years was sufficient time for somebody to be able to carry through a program of improvement and change, and so you had stability. And if you like, the decision taken was that there would be an election by thirds. Now, can I say personally, I think that confuses people in Bristol entirely. Nobody understands the year when there isn't an election and everybody panics because they haven't had a polling card, and you have to tell them there isn't one. And I think it was done in relation to looking at the ability to manage, if you like, the political control of the council rather than have all out and all in. Personally, I favour all out and all in, and I favour that on the basis that I do think it gives stability and better understanding, and I think it does give whoever's in control, and John is at the minute, but I think it gives whichever party the chance to be able to deliver whatever they want to do, or put up or shut up, basically.
John, can you just give us a bit of an insight into what changes we're likely to see, which I imagine are beginning to kick in now after last week's election in the Liberal group, because the Liberals were actually controlling the council beforehand, weren't they?
Yes, I mean, we were the largest party, and we took over the administration at the end of February when Labour and the Conservatives, who had been working together or voted together, Labour actually quit. We were in a situation of the last election, this election that's just gone, where we were looking for four more seats. There are 70 seats across the city, and we needed 36 to have an overall majority. So we needed four more seats, and we achieved that last Thursday. And the big difference now is that we already know who the leader of council will be on Tuesday. We're not waiting to have horse trading and trying to agree between the parties. We have an absolute majority, and so Barbara Jank is the new leader of the council. That will be confirmed at the AGM on Tuesday. The cabinet is actually essentially unchanged. The only change is Councillor Tim Kent has stood down. He had a housing portfolio and he's replaced by Councillor Mark Wright. But I, for example, am still in charge of transport and sustainability in the city. Gary Hopkins is in charge of waste and environment and so on. We won the election on the basis of a slogan, six to fix, and we said there were six main issues that we wanted to see change in Bristol, a recipe. And unlike in February when we took over really because Labour had quit, we are now in a situation where we have a mandate for that, and we have said this is what we're going to do, and we will now set about doing that.
Well, without taking too long, can you go through those six things then?
Yeah, the six things were cutting congestion. We need to improve our transport.
And that's
services.
Your job, isn't it? As a
that's
transport.
Me. Yeah. So that's including suburban rail.
There may be people sitting in traffic jams out there now, John, thinking, oh, we hope you're going to get on with it.
We need to get on with that and quickly. Improving road safety, that would be things like 20-mile-per-hour zones in residential areas. A cleaner and greener city, boosting the Bristol's bobbies. We're going to push to get a proper share of police in the city. We've promised three new libraries, a new school and a new pool. We're also helping various measures to try and improve employment and beating the recession in the city. Pledged to increase to 50% recycling by 2010.
So you won't mind if I bring you in a year's time just to make sure you have fulfilled.
Well, 50% recycling by 2010. To be fair, that's December 2010. So we're sort of, you know, doing a typical politician thing of actually saying it's going to be slightly longer. We need the summer to do that. The recycling is all about education. Ron said he wasn't sure. A lot of people aren't sure about it. You have to talk to people on a one-to-one basis to increase recycling, and we're going to put big investment into doing that over the coming year. But the summer is the time to do that, and sadly, this summer, it's going to be too late to set up such service. And we're also scrapping the incinerator plans, and we'll have much cleaner and smarter technologies to deal with our residual waste.
So, Ron, you know, how are you going to be, as part of the Labour group, how are you going to be making sure that the Liberals are delivering for the city, even though you're in a sort of backseat
the
position?
The basic answer to that is that they won't, because clearly the existing capital programme and in the budget that they put up with Tory support this year, has no monies in it for three new libraries or a new pool. I don't know where they're going to go with that. The only way that they can get monies in relation to some of the issues that they want to do is obviously to bring in cuts in services and make people redundant in a recession. In relation to recycling in 50%, I mean, we've seen what's happened in the bin strike already, and some of that is certainly behind the issue. We didn't quit as such. We were faced with a budget that gave you, as taxpayers, £350 million debt for 30 years round your neck. And to pay that off without putting up the council tax meant to say we would have to sack and cut frontline services, and that was an agenda we weren't prepared to accept. So the argument about the incinerator is not just about incineration and the waste, but it's also about how you actually fund whatever you're doing. And currently we've lost the ability for the government grant that we had for that. And so have the partners that surround this particular city. Because as you saw yesterday, South Gloucester's decided to build its own on Severnside and go on its own. And Gary has announced that none of our waste will cross the borders, which sounds a bit like rattles out the pram to me.
Well, we'll have to wait and see whether John and his party, the Liberals, are able to fulfil some of these things. And I'm sorry to say that's all we've got time for this week. It's coming up to about 6 o'clock, and I hope you'll be able to join us on Friday Drive Time every week here on BCFM. Well, we'll be doing our best to pick apart some of the less well-reported news in Bristol, Britain and around the world. And next week, Lib Dem councillor and the man in charge of value for money, Mike Popham, will be here, as well as Charlie Bolton, who hails from Southville and is Bristol's only Green councillor. If you have news you want discussed, questions about tonight's programme, or would like to suggest a topic for future shows, please email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks to our reporter Neil Roberts. Our guests were Lib Dem Councillor for Ashley Ward, John Rogers, and Labour Councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. We have about 60 million people in Britain and 60 million acres of land, so while it might feel sometimes there's not enough resources to go around, that's only because corporations and the super rich have taken quite literally piles and piles more than their fair share. All we have to do is make sure that 60 million acres is shared out, and with modern technology, not controlled by a rich elite, we can all live quite happily together. Do please join me for Friday Drive Time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
You are listening on BCFM 93.2 FM. It is your voice.